What is a rare disease?
Well, it depends on what portion of the globe you're standing on. But to a major degree, the rarity or rare disease is defined by its prevalence. In other words, how many people per 10,000 might be afflicted by the disease. So different parts of the globe have different definitions. It seems to be a moving target. It's always a relative term related to the general population. But for example, in the United States, if it's 7.5 persons per 10,000, it's a rare disease. So that's an example in the United States. In Europe, it's 5 people per 10,000. In Japan, has a different prevalence rate that makes it be defined as rare. The World Health Organization even has a definition that is different than the rest. So it's a relative term and a moving target.
Are they all kind of similar, kind of in the same neighborhood, or are they really just all over the place?
The differences between them are not significant. And I would venture to say arbitrary. I really don't know. Never seen, as long as I've been studying this phenomena, I've never seen justification for declaring a certain prevalence rate as rare. Really, the biggest implication of the definition is the social consequences.
So for the U.S., can you give us an idea of how many rare diseases we have defined here?
Right. I've seen estimates from the Office of Rare Disease at the National Institute of Health. They estimate 4,000 to 6,000. Sometimes they'll even go up to 7,000 rare diseases. But let's remember, when we say rare disease, many of them, and most of them, I would say, have names to them. But there's some patients out there living with a rare genetic condition with a cluster of symptoms that don't even have a name to them yet, don't have a IBD billing number for a physician to categorize it or for insurance coverage to apply to them. So it's always an estimated number. Another reason why it's hard to target the exact number is the epidemiological surveillance of rare disease is not like what you would find for some of the more common diseases. In other words, our epidemiologists at the CDC aren't keeping close track of the incidence of rare disease like they are of the Ebola or some other things that are out there.
If you're just tuning in, this is Science Cafe Little Rock, talking with Pam Williams, Associate Professor of Nursing at UAMS, about rare diseases. Our number here in the studio, 569-8494, if you want to call in with your question. So I'm sure you can give us lots of examples of rare diseases we've never heard of. Can you think of some that our listening audience might be a little bit more familiar with?
I think you can relate to some of these that I'm going to call off. And remember now, rare diseases are conditions that can affect you at birth, or sometimes you're born with the genetic information or your genetics already determine you're going to get the disease, but you don't see the symptoms until later in adulthood. So some of the ones that occur in early childhood that we see and are often detected through our newborn screening panels that are required in the United States are things like cystic fibrosis. That's a rare disease when you consider the incidence of that condition across the general population. In the adult symptom onset, another one that people hear about is Huntington's disease. That's a rare genetic condition. Sickle cell anemia, which has a prevalence rate that's higher in the African American population and has clinics dedicated to its treatment at UAMS. That's, when you think about prevalence rates against the general population out there, it also is classified by the Office of Rare Diseases as a rare genetic condition.
Our phone number, 569-8494, if you have a question for Pam about rare diseases. Now, you mentioned the classification of something as a rare disease is really most significant because of its social context. Can you talk a little bit more about what that means?
Yeah, I'd love to. There are definite social implications of living with a rare disease, and this is the principal phenomena that I study in my research. When one is diagnosed with a rare disease, they're going to run into some social implications within the healthcare system and healthcare delivery. They're going to run into the problem that drug companies don't want to develop drugs for them because there's no profit margin in it. They're going to run into the fact that finding an adequate or competent provider is going to be very difficult because that provider either didn't learn very much about that condition in medical school, or if they did, they haven't retained it because they don't see it often enough in their medical practice. They're going to run into the situation of having to drive long distances to find providers that are competent to treat them. They're also going to experience delays in diagnosis. Again, a problem because it's not frequently seen, and so it runs to the bottom of a differential diagnosis when a physician is going through the process. They always will put in their differential diagnosis preparation the most likely candidates that your symptoms may be a result of, rather than what they refer to as the zebras. They're trained in medical school not to look for the zebras.
So what you're saying is, you know, somebody comes in who has a rare disease, the doctor doesn't know it yet, it's going to take him a while to go through that decision tree to find out what's going on.
Is that right?
Did I understand right? That's right.
So delays in diagnosis is one of those social, results. What I refer to as a health disparity. In my work, I am trying to develop a measurement so that we can look at some of these health disparities I just mentioned that cross over and many of the rare diseases have in common.
569-8494 is the phone number here if you have a question about rare diseases for Pam Williams. She is an associate professor of nursing at UAMS. When you mentioned some of the challenges that people with rare diseases run into, you know, we live in a very connected world with the internet and with access to our, you know, health records, access to all sorts of information out there. Are there services or systems in place to help these individuals get better care or access better care or not have such a problem with these obstacles that they might have had, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, this is interesting. What we have witnessed in the last 10 years, I would say, is the development of the really active patient advocate. And this is because they have been driven to come together via the internet and find solutions themselves. They have empowered themselves to come together and form alliances via the internet, chat rooms, blogs, websites, and form a collective identity and pursue better healthcare delivery through research with each other. And that has been a driving force in my research. So I think I would like to give credit to two other patient advocacy movements that have served as really good models, and that would be the AIDS patient advocacy movement and the breast cancer advocacy movement. Those two patient advocacy movements have historically provided really excellent models for the rare disease community to come together, and we're seeing that occur more and more often.
Looks like we have a caller on the line, Jeff from North Little Rock. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, Jeff, what's your question for Pam?
Hi, Pam. My daughter is 4 years old, and she has a very rare chromosomal disorder called tetrisomy 18P. And you were talking about a delay in diagnosis, and I just wanted to quickly share my story about what we went through when she was much younger. Spent 4 months at Arkansas Children's because basically they refused to do a genetic test because, like you said, they were looking for the most obvious stuff first and kind of just bypassed looking at anything genetic. So it's a real thing. It really does exist. And my wife asked for genetic testing, and they wouldn't give it to us. And I think we spent a lot of time in the hospital that we didn't need to because of that.
Thanks, Jeff, for your call. This is an interesting phenomenon we're seeing more and more. And you made reference to genetic testing. You know, that is one of the phenomena of the late 1900s and the turn of the century, the mapping of the human genome. And we are seeing more and more genetic technology being used. And if you go to the NIH website, you'll see it sometimes referred to as personalized medicine, where genetic technology is supposed to be providing us a very personalized, tailored diagnostic process based on our genetics. Well, unfortunately, the hype and the excitement we're a little bit behind the curve in making it apply all the time and consistently. But just imagine if you hadn't had that genetic testing, you would still be looking for an answer to your situation. So my field of science is looking at how that genetic technology has really opened the door for people living with rare diseases. And, you know, sometimes it's a good thing and sometimes it's a bad thing. Take, for example, the family who has Huntington's disease in it, and they know that they have had a daughter. Let's just say your daughter was born to a family with Huntington's disease in it. Now, because the technology does allow you to find out whether or not you will or won't get Huntington's disease, now we've got things like testing burden. So although you're in your family situation, you were really advocating getting a test, other families are facing that question of, wow, I don't know if I really want to know. I mean, let me find out when I need to know. Let me wait till the symptoms are here. Of course, when a child is born with symptoms, we want answers and we want them fast. And I'm glad you did finally get persuade the authorities to get involved with genetic testing. And I'm also glad to hear that you as caregivers are proactive in being the advocate for your person with a rare disorder. You will continue to meet, Jeff, you will continue to need to be your daughter's advocate.
Jeff, are you still there?
Yes.
How has your experience changed since you've gotten the diagnosis? Have you been able to get access to healthcare and find people in the medical field who can help you?
Well, that's another thing I was thinking about when I listened to the first part of the show was research for chromosome 18 disorders is there is some out there, and there's a registry that coordinates things and tries to raise money, but it's so rare that not a lot of people are looking to try to find out more about it.
I can't emphasize how important it is for you to participate in the research registry. That's one of the things these rare disease communities are doing to jumpstart research, is to form these registries so that when there is a scientist that will take the time to study your condition, they don't have to spend years gathering and searching for the adequate number, the scientific N, as we call it. They don't have to spend years gathering the locations of these people with the same rare disorder. And so I'm a really big advocate of rare disease registries and rare disease biobanks. So you might also want to look and see at whether or not anybody's collecting samples and biobanking them.
The chromosome 18 registry does do that. Now, we have not done that with my daughter, but I know that a lot of people have.
So biobank registries and registries and biobanks and the web and online support communities are your key to being the best advocate you can be for your daughter.
Well, Jeff, thanks so much for calling in. We appreciate it, and good luck with you.
Thank you all.
So you had mentioned that you know, these social groups that have come together through blogs and websites and our technology. I should give the phone number again, 569-8494, for anyone else who wants to call in. We've been talking with Jeff, but the phone lines are open now. If you have a question for Pam. So these social networks that are kind of developing around these communities with rare conditions, have we actually seen an impact in the quality of life for the people or the families affected by this, or in terms of public policy? What have the impacts been?
Absolutely. What we've seen, let's first start with policy. Patient advocates were successful in getting passed a piece of legislation in 2002, the Rare Disease Act. And it was through patient advocates going to the Hill, and it was a piece of legislation sponsored by the late Ted Kennedy, passed the Rare Disease Act. And what happened out of that piece of legislation was an office was finally developed and established at the National Institute of Health to pay attention to these populations living with rare diseases. Now, we're not all the way there, folks. Right now, it's only an office of rare diseases. It's not an institute like lung disease, the more common diseases get. But at least it's an office. And out of this office of rare diseases, some centers of excellence around the country at scientific institutions have been established to focus on these rare diseases. Again, patient advocates are the wheel that drives policy getting passed. Another wonderful result of patient advocacy is, and I want to make sure this gets passed on to everybody in the audience that's living with a rare disease, that the last day of February every year is a global observance around the globe of Rare Disease Day, and it recognizes the when we come together as a collective, the rare disease communities come together as a large collective. In North America alone, we're talking about 25 million people. And we're talking about, I've heard it expressed in another way, it's of in the listening audience tonight, 1 out of 10 people listening have a family member affected by a rare disease. So what I'm telling you is we have the power to create change in healthcare delivery and the allocation of research resources, but we have to come together as a collective, and rare diseases are not rare. That's the answer to that question. It's not a rare phenomena.
Pam, I think we have another caller on the line. Hi, what's your question for Pam?
My name is Kristen, and can you hear me?
We can. Hi, Kristen. Thanks for calling in.
Well, it was two-part. I'm learning a lot about the advocacy groups, but when I was a kid, my father found out at 30 that he had hereditary telangiectasia, and, hemorrhagic telangiectasia. Anyway, basically, it was a nightmare because they spent months trying to convince, you know, doctors that it wasn't Ebola and that it wasn't all kinds of other crazy things. And I'm trying to figure out what is the best way. Are there any tips you can give for one-on-one interaction with these doctors? Because the first reaction is always, in my opinion, an arrogant response to, of course not. You know, what are you talking about? You don't know what you're talking about. What would you do in situations like that?
Well, you need to understand that you do not have to tolerate that. And I'm all about empowering patients to not accept being dismissed and your thoughts about and participation and partnering in the differential diagnosis with your physician. So I'm disappointed to hear that goes on, and I'm always disappointed when I hear about that. And I don't know how far you get by being argumentative with a physician that is not enlightened, but there's so many physicians out there that in this day and age, I would hope that you would seek another opinion and find a more enlightened physician that is willing to partner with the patient to let the patient be involved in finding the correct diagnosis.
Thanks for your call, Kristen. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
So back to policy a little bit.
Right.
I know when I was in my training, I heard about the Orphan Drug Act of 1983. So we are quite a ways out from that. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what that did and if that's made any difference?
Yeah. Okay. So in addition, after the Rare Disease Act, the Orphan Drug Act followed close behind. And what that was supposed to do is to jumpstart and give pharmaceutical companies some incentives to pursue therapeutic development, drug development for rare conditions that there was obviously no profit margin. And there has been some strides done. For example, in cystic fibrosis, they have made some remarkable progress in therapeutics. So now that now in cystic fibrosis, we're seeing the life expectancy greatly expanded. We're also seeing off-label use of pharmaceuticals, and some physicians are willing to explore off-label uses. An example is, and another example of therapeutic development inspired by the Orphan Drug Act, is some of the drugs that we're seeing now used in sickle cell anemia that we were not seeing previously, so that children are getting therapeutic drugs for their sickle cell, and they're seeing some really good results. We haven't cured it, but we have expanded the life expectancy of those two rare diseases. So it's not dismal for all of them, but both of those, cystic fibrosis and sickle cell, are some of the more common rare diseases, if you'll excuse that paradox of it being a common rare disease. That sounds kind of like a oxymoron.
Well, Pam, we are actually out of time.
Oh, no.
This has gone by very fast. It's been a great discussion. I do want to remind everyone about World Rare Disease Day, February 28th, coming up.
Yes. Go online, if I can just get one little plug in there.
Go fast.
Go rarediseases.org.
Thank you, Pam. And if you want to hear more, Pam and I are heading up to the Afterthought in the Hillcrest area of Little Rock to expand our conversation about rare diseases. We'll have a couple of other panelists in addition to Pam. Dr. Daniel Voth will be talking about some rare infectious diseases. He's an associate professor of microbiology and immunology at UAMS. And on the other end of the spectrum, Maya Lopez, an associate professor of pediatrics from Children's Hospital, will be talking about autism, which a while back was rare, but not so rare anymore. So we'll talk about the approaches in medicine and some of the details and some strides in public policy. So join us. Thank you so much for listening. For KUAR FM 89 and Science Cafe Little Rock, I'm Dorothy Graves.
Support for programming is provided by UAMS, whose Women's Mental Health Program at the Psychiatric Research Institute is making a difference in the lives of women throughout the state. Visit UAMSHealth.com.